WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new year is a time for reviewing one's life, and hardly anyone is better at that than Spalding Gray. For over a decade now, he's been chronicling his life in a series of autobiographical monologues. He's part memoirist, part actor, part journalist, avant-gardist, and comic. Spalding Gray, alone on stage, telling stories of what's happened in his life lately, gets me laughing more than most movie and Broadway comedies do. But his confessions have the depth and insight to leave me emotionally moved. Some of his funniest stories have been about trying to fit into Hollywood. Maybe you've seen him in Beaches, Clara's Heart, or The Killing Fields. Of course, the film that best showed what sets him apart from other actors was the film of his monologue, Swimming to Cambodia, which was about the making of The Killing Fields. His new monologue is called Monster in a Box. The monster is a 1,600-page manuscript. It's Gray's first novel. The monologue is about all the interruptions that kept preventing him from finishing the novel. Gray is performing Monster in a Box at Lincoln Center in New York, and his run has been extended into February. Gray took the piece on the road before opening in New York, and when he was in Philadelphia in September, we invited him to perform an excerpt of Monster in a Box on Fresh Air and to talk with us about it later. So here's Spalding Gray with an excerpt of Monster in a Box.
So I got this contract to write this book, and it started to turn into this huge autobiographic novel, and I knew that that's all I wanted to do, because I had this idea that I'd been doing monologues for so long that I was too extroverted, and I wanted to get more introverted, in touch with my private self, and work in a more private way of writing, and I thought, I'll just do the book. In order to do the book and be private, I thought I would apply to a writer's colony, and I applied to the McDowell Colony in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and I thought, if they accept me, that'll prove I'm a writer. And they did accept me, and I was very excited because, well, a number of great writers had gone there, including Thornton Wilder, who had written Our Town and had modeled the town of Peterborough, New Hampshire, as the town for Grover's Corners. And I arrive at 600 acres of land with about 52 private cabins on it. Each person has their own little house to work in, and it was wonderful. You could do anything in that house. I mean, no one could bother you. There was no telephone. They brought you lunch and delivered it in a little basket, put it on the steps and tiptoed away like Yogi Bear and left you alone. You could do anything in that house, which was fantastic for me to consider, being in a house and being able to do anything I wanted in New England. That was unique. So I began the writing process, and basically I hated it. It was dreadful. I was writing 3-4 hours a day longhand, doing the book longhand. I mean, I wanted to isolate myself up there, just write. No living, just writing. And I'm writing away, and I'm beginning to have my knuckles swelling from the pressure of the pen. My knuckle is swelling up and becoming arthritic from so much writing, and then I'm beginning to lose my sight in my left eye. And this makes me very upset because the book I'm working on is all about my Oedipal themes, and I think, oh no, there goes the first eye. So I'm writing, and then when I can't write anymore, it's 3 hours, 4 hours, I'm walking. What do? I walk in the woods, and I walk, and I walk, and I get back to the main house where we're supposed to eat dinner, and I drink, and I eat, and I reread what I wrote, and I get up in the morning, and I write, and I walk, and I drink, and I drink, and I drink, and I eat, and I reread what I wrote, and I get up in the morning, and I write, and I write, and I write, and I write, and I drink, and I drink, and I drink, and I eat, and I reread what I wrote, and I drink, and I drink, and I drink, and I was thinking, anything, get anything, please, something get me out of here. Someone call me and get me out of this place. So I got a telephone call at the main house asking me to come out to Los Angeles to do a project that the Mark Taper Forum Theater had applied for a grant to have me out there to do a year ago. Wonderful. They had applied to the National Endowment for the Arts. That was back in the old days when the NEA was doing wild and crazy things like that, investing in people like Spalding Gray. And the idea was that I would come to Los Angeles and look for people who were not involved in the film industry and interview them on stage. It was to be called L.A. The Other, just talking to simple folks about living in L.A. I was supposed to ride the buses of Los Angeles to find them. So I thought, this is wonderful. It will get me out of here. I'll work on my book in the morning in Los Angeles, and then in the afternoon I'll go looking for L.A. The Other. So I get out there. The Mark Taper Forum rents Renee Shafransky and I this Hollywood bungalow in the Hollywood Hills, a tiny little house, and the one thing I find fantastic, it has a view. I never knew how important a view was to me. I mean, in New York City, I have a view of a roof, a tar paper roof in another building. At the McDowell Colony, I was looking out at trees. Suddenly, I have this view of a snow-capped mountain in 20 miles in the distance, a city with a mountain by it with snow on it, when you could see it, the 7 clear days of the year. And I'd wake up in the morning, and it was beautiful, the birds chirping and the wind chimes, and see the sun coming through the bedroom window. And I'd get up and go in to my writing table and sit down with my book and feel the sun coming across the desk, across my arms, and follow the sun, and follow the sun around into the living room, and sit down and watch the sun come through the cypress trees, and watch the sun come through the palm trees, and have a cup of coffee, and have another cup of coffee, and watch the sun come round and come through the dining room, and watch the sun go down through the dining room window, and have a martini, and watch the sun set into the Pacific Ocean, and have another martini. Why go out? Why bother? Why work on a book?
Spalding Gray, performing an excerpt of his new monologue, Monster in a Box. So you've got 1,600 pages, which I believe are now sitting on your editor's desk.
Right.
What's the plan? Is the editor going to read all 1,600?
He's supposed to be doing that. Yeah. I just lost one editor, Knopf.
He
went back to school. He dropped out and went back to architectural school. But he didn't... I knew something was going on, weird, but you know how they don't tell you until it's happening. So he was doing the best he could to collate it with me, and what we were doing was talking about where it needed bridges and what were chapters. And also, one of the things I was struggling with and learning more about is that I can't do the long digressions that I do in a monologue, in a novel, because it's hard to hold the audience. I had a 250-page digression, and which I started telling the story on the beach in Australia and went for 250 pages just telling the story. And I realized that my body, my presence, is a duality in the monologue that I really like. I'm always grounding the audience. I'm always there physically, and I'm not in the book. So that was a struggle, and we were working with that. Then he quit, and I got assigned the hot editor, Gary Fitzdijon, who did Jay McInerney and Raymond Carver. And I thought, well, this is good. He's not of he's not in my kind of sensitivity scene. It's a little bit more Hemingway cowboy-esque, but Gary was hot to do it. That's the only word I can use. So I dumped the whole thing on his lap on June 25th, and he hasn't gotten through it yet. And he promised that by the end of my tour he would, and he claims he's working on it. So maybe this thing is just asking too much, you know. I'd have to hire a real editor that really, really loved me, because it's like choking a horse, this damn thing.
let me ask you to describe briefly what the novel is about.
Yeah. It's an odyssey of a guy, as I refer to him, a guy who's trying to become a man, by learning the art of hanging out and taking pleasure and joy in the simply being able to be alone in a vacation setting or a paradisical session. His one problem is that he's never really worked much before, so it's kind of a contradiction in terms to say that he wants to learn how to take a vacation, but I like the title, Impossible Vacation. And he feels that he can't commit to the woman he's with, Cleo, his girlfriend, and try to settle down and have a family until he takes this one last big trip alone where he learns how to be a guy hanging out, and he's set on doing it in Bali. And he's taking the money, finally, that his mother's left him after she committed suicide. And then it's all of those misadventures on the way of this odyssey in which he remembers back. It's flashbacks of remembering. So it's about the women in his life, of which there are three major relationships: his mother, a woman after that, and then Cleo, the one that he's with then. And so that's kind of the plot. And then it's about every kind of phobia and digression. And it's about obsessive behavior and drinking and obsession with beer and getting drunk and all of those male things.
And all those things
and
that
sex,
you probably have, right?
And masturbation,
right?
And all of those things. All of those that I had now. I've stopped drinking, and because of that, and I'm older, so I masturbate lesser. Maybe I don't know what's caused the decline in masturbation. I think it was an eye operation I had on my left eye, actually.
So experiencing pleasure is something you have talked about in your monologues,
right,
as always having problems with. You're always looking for the perfect moment, never quite finding it. Did you take a vacation this summer? Did you get away?
I took a vacation, but it was... it was for 10 days, and it was the strangest one I've ever had. It was in Amagansett on Long Island, in a small cottage, very teeny little shack on a salt pond, very beautiful setting. And And I didn't vacate. You see, I gave up drinking for the first time, alcohol, since 1976. And I have never lived in a summer in my adult life where I didn't at least have a lot of white wine with fish. I mean, they go hand in hand. And I was also told by one doctor, I've been to many, there's a whole other monologue in that, that I had a high level of mercury. So I had to cut out all big fish because that's problematic with the cataracts. And so all of a sudden, there goes tuna fish, swordfish, and salmon. And I'm out there in the water and I'm not drinking and I'm getting prepared for an eye operation, so I could hardly call it a vacation. So Renee said, well, we'll try to take one to Costa Rica because the beaches are beautiful in January. So, and when she said that, the beaches are beautiful, Costa Rica, I got panicked because again, I feel that enormous pressure to have these ultimate perfect moments. And I don't want to do that. What I'm leaning more toward in my life now is, and I'm reading more and more Zen books. I think that's foolish. People who read Zen, they should be practicing it. But I'm reading the books, getting ready to practice it, trying to find a more middle ground of the ultimate challenges. The Zen, the wonderful Zen story where the kind of flamboyant, magical Hindu is saying, boasting about how he can materialize jewels out of the air and walk on the water. And the Zen monk says, well, that's nothing. I do the ultimate miracle. When I'm hungry, I eat. When I'm tired, I sleep. So I think, well, if I can slow down and begin to experience simple joys and have everything more polymorphous, primorous, and everything like a vacation, that's what I ideally like, rather than this crazy thing of working and then trying to relax with a capital R, which is what America is all about and why it's so crazy. So I just don't know. The idea of a vacation frightens me. The best vacations for me are working on films, when I'm on a film set and I'm doing a small role.
Right, because you don't have to work that hard.
It's enforced, and you're with interesting people in a nice location, and they're feeding you well, and they're taking care of you. And then you do 2 or 3 days' work.
And you're under no obligation to really enjoy yourself, because after all,
right,
you're working.
That's right. The obligation, exactly. That's what gets it.
Does knowing that you're reporting on your life ever enhance the pleasure of it, or do you think it distances you more from
it? I think it distances me. And, one of the particular books I was reading on Vipassana meditation this morning, and I'm starting to get more interested in that, was that they say, are you one of those people that when you're walking in the woods, you're thinking about what a great story this will make for your friends? And I underlined that in green ink, and I thought, but wait a minute, that is my profession after all. And after all, I do enjoy telling stories, and after all, I'm very present when I'm telling the story. So what I see myself as doing is that's a form of sacrifice. That's part of the work. But I do find it's a distancing.
Spalding Gray is my guest. He's performing his new monologue, Monster in a Box, at Lincoln Center in New York. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Actor and writer Spalding Gray is my guest. Was there ever doubt in your mind that you would be doing another monologue? It's been several years since your past.
There's always a doubt. There's always a doubt. And now that I'm doing this one, there's a certain regeneration of productivity where I feel another one coming up behind it like a burp, and or like planes on a runway. So I think I'm back into it again, but I don't know. I never know when it's coming until this burning issue that comes up, or where I've done something large, like climb a mountain. Writing that book was climbing a mountain for me. And now there's this thing that's happened to my left eye, which was enormously disturbing and changed my life in a major way, because I didn't expect anything to happen to me until I was 50. My girlfriend's mother is always saying, from 50 to 55 is the Bermuda Triangle of health. And if you get past 55, you'll live to be 80. So I was believing this. So, but I got it at 49, and suddenly that caused a lot of shakeup and a lot of investigating around what caused it, what were the issues, what did various people think about this. And that investigating has led to more journals and a lot of information that I could probably do an hour's worth of material for an audience next week. It's that close to being born as a new monologue.
What's the problem exactly with your eye?
It's rather esoteric, although I'm told by the doctor that it's quite common now, or more common. But what happened was my vitreous humor liquefied, the vitreous humor in my left eye, and it pulled away from the retina and left a big piece of it on the retina, so on the macula, which is center of the retina, and I had what was called a macula pucker. Now, everyone laughs at that because it sounds like my lawyer says, yeah, I had a girlfriend named Macula Pucker in high school. She had syphilis. You know, this kind of thing. But macula pucker is that you have to look at the retina. It's like a screen, and the jellies on it, that tissue, is making it pucker up and bunch like a piece of saran wrap bunching. So you have enormous distortion of vision. And what they have to do is peel that with microsurgery, if you want the operation, if you want to take the risk. They actually cut into your eye in three places and peel that tissue without touching, theoretically without touching the retina. And I did a lot of shopping around to find the right surgeon. And I knew I had the right surgeon finally when I was waiting in his waiting room the last day to see him, and they had just dilated my pupils, and no one else was in the waiting room. It was a Friday morning. And this little man comes out of my doctor's office. It's like an old-time movie. He's moving very sporadically and fast, and he's got a Nixon mask on. And I think, what in hell is that man doing with a Nixon mask on this day and age? And, of course, my eyes were dilated, and he comes closer to me, and I realize it is Richard Nixon. And he comes right over to me as if he's going to say, I saw Swimming to Cambodia and loved it. But then I realized that he was waiting for me to ask him for an autograph. And I looked up stunned with my eyes dilated, going, and I went, oh, hi. And that's all I said. I went into my doctor's office. I said, was that Nixon? And the doctor said, yes, nothing wrong with him. And I said, well, there is no justice in the world, is there? And then the doctor got very defensive. And he said, well, there is nothing wrong with what Nixon did when you consider what Reagan did. And it occurred to me at that point that I did not want to know my surgeon's politics.
So did you have the procedure already?
Yeah, I've had it August 7th. I'm back to 20/40 vision, but that's non-correctable. But it was better than what I had. I had 20/200, and I can cover my right eye, and I can tell who you are, although it's not... What happens is I've lost the definition because the macula is responsible. But finding people that had this was such a task, and I couldn't commiserate. And I put an ad in the Village Voice.
Really?
It said, macula pucker, ? Does anyone have one? Let's share notes. And no one wrote in, so I got really frightened. And then I finally found a woman that did have it. And she decided not to have the operation because she had helped found the emergency room at Roosevelt Hospital. And she said, if you knew what I knew about the inside of hospitals, you would not risk this operation. So I ignored what she said and went through with it. And I didn't get infection, and I'm better. I'm getting better.
Now, you're the kind of person who is always sure they're coming down with something, right? Or something's going to go wrong.
Well,
or,
I'm what you call a hypochondriac. Right. I have those tendencies. I think very narcissistic people have them all the time.
So what's it like for you to actually have a quantifiable, definitive problem?
It was so strangely good. And you can tell by talking to me that I'm not real depressed about it, because it was incredible to have. And all of this stuff came into play around the book, because I talk about losing my sight and writing Oedipal themes and thinking that it had to do with that. But when I talk about getting my anxiety into focus, all of this eye imagery comes up, because I am getting my anxiety into focus. And so suddenly that helped. I woke up in the morning and I knew specifically what to be anxious about and how to go about dealing with the problem. And this was very refreshing in a weird kind of way. It was strange. It really drew everything together, and all the other things were gone.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Because you had something to focus all that energy into.
Yeah. And of course, you get into a thing where you start playing around with praying to God, saying, all right, if this is what's got to be wrong with me, fine, but let my kidneys and my heart and my lungs go on till I'm 80. You know, you think that just because you get the one thing wrong, that everything's going to go fine. But it was a trying time, but also a very focused time.
I've been watching your performances for a long time. I remember back in, I guess it was 77, you did something called Rumstick Road.
Right.
And it was a two-person piece.
No.
Three persons?
Four, actually.
Four,
if you count
okay.
The technician who was on
which
stage.
I didn't, yes.
Right. He was supposed to be part of the show.
Well, anyways, this was largely about your mother, who was a Christian Scientist, and her suicide.
Right.
And it was presented more, well, as, like tragedy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was drama. It was not a humorous monologue
right.
in any way. Over the years, I guess as time has gone by, you're still talking about your mother
right.
in your work and her influence on you and her suicide. But it's taken this kind of like dual nature.
Yeah.
It's both tragic and comic.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you could talk about how The
process of that.
Yeah, the process of humor that's, starting in,
but that's
to enter into
that's an interesting and good question. And I've talked about it a few times when I've done public talks about the work. But I think that I went through an extremely healing process through art in regards to the suicide, because I did go through the depression, not being able to mourn it, and all of the stuff that they talk about. And when I co-founded the Worcester Group with Elizabeth LeCompte in New York City in the Performing Garage in 1977, we were working on a series of autobiographical pieces. And that sprung me out. And every night at the end of that, I would walk out like Jimmy Durante in three spotlights and wave goodbye to the entire You know, even now I get choked up thinking about it, to the audience, to the group, and walk out the garage door, the performing garage door. And around that time, 1979, I was doing my first monologue. And I didn't know that they were going to be funny. But my New England timing, my New England accent, my New England understatement was funny to all the New York Jews. If I had stayed in Boston and done them, no one would have laughed. You know, it saved me. The New York audience saved me and gave me my sense of humor. So that helped birth it.
I've got a kind of weird question for you. It's the Willem Dafoe question.
Yeah.
Willem Dafoe, I think, still lives with Elizabeth Lacombe,
right,
who you used to live with,
right,
and you used to collaborate with on your performances. And now he's become a big movie star.
Right.
Whereas you've been in the movies, but you're, I think, still best known in a lot of ways for the stuff that you're doing yourself, for
mm-hmm.
this like really offbeat kind of storytelling,
right,
that you do. Do you ever wish for the kind of life that he has? Because I wonder if you feel like he's your secret sharer in some way, like the alternate life you could have had.
I don't think I could have had what Willem has, although I long to have it sometimes because it looks good when I'm schlepping around, living out of a suitcase. And other times, my stuff is so fulfilling that I always know that my work is fulfilling when I'm not looking elsewhere. And that's a good percentage of the time. But I don't feel replaced by Willem because he's a completely different. One of the things Willem does very well is work in front of a camera. The camera loves him and he loves the camera. He's less effective on stage live when we're working with the Worcester Group. He doesn't have the same presence and aura, although he's good. He's much better on camera, particularly in Last Temptations of Christ. I thought he was excellent. One of the things about me in Hollywood, and I've said this recently in interviews, to paraphrase Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan says, "I may look like Robert Frost, but I feel just like Jesse James." I paraphrase it to say, "I may look like the American ambassador's aide, but I feel just like Woody Allen." And what the problem is with Hollywood is they're always casting for type and look. And Willem has a very versatile, good look to do tough guys, Christ, what have you. I'm stuck in this kind of New England WASP Brahmin where they're casting me as lawyers and doctors and gynecologists and American ambassador's aides. And inside is this very ironic, perverse sense of humor that has never found its right role in film yet. And I think it would have to be built around me. So I think I envy Woody Allen more than Willem, because he really has made his own genre around himself, and I think that's the supremo act to do. Willem still is not in control, you see. He's in control as long as he's marketable. But Woody Allen has got it all down, and I have it down in a smaller arena, and I'm still happy with it.
I just want to check in with you on one issue, and that is, are you and Renee still thinking of having children, or is that
we're doing more than thinking.
You're having one?
Yeah, no, we're working. We're not thinking about it. She now knows when she's ovulating, and so that's when we either have sex or make love. It's more like having sex because it's very clinical. Now I'm ovulating. Now see if you can get some of that sperm into me. So now we're that much closer to it, and I'm much more open to it than I have ever been in my life, because I've really reached a place now where my work, I trust it. I trust it to come. I trust the process. And I trust that certainly attempting to have a baby is everyone's, or many people's story. It's the history of the human race. So there's another monologue.
And if there wasn't, would you feel different about it?
If there wasn't a monologue in it, yes, I would feel. I mean, one of the reasons I started doing monologues was to save myself from the fear of chaos, that things would not be redeemable through some form. And in my case, it's the storytelling form that redeems all things except perhaps my own death. And then with the proper medium, I may be able to tell about that.
Spalding Gray, it's always great to talk with you. Thanks a lot for coming.
Well, thank you. It's good talking with you.
Spalding Gray is performing his monologue, Monster in a Box, at Lincoln Center in New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.